Today, our guest is Daniel Lewy, and we'll be talking about rare diseases, patient advocacy, and much more. Don't go away.
O maior evento para os profissionais da indústria farmacêutica em Portugal é já no dia 6 de junho, em Lisboa. Ricardo Batista Leite e Daniel Guedelha são os keynote speakers de um dia que promete muitas surpresas. Todas as informações e inscrições em www.rethinkingpharma.pt.
Welcome to this episode of the Cruzamento podcast. Before we start the show, thank you very much for your amazing feedback. Please continue to share your thoughts, and if you enjoy our content, also consider giving us a 5-star rating on Spotify, YouTube, or Apple Podcast. That would support a lot our mission of spreading knowledge. So now back to the show. Today, we are exploring the intersection of technology and healthcare. I'm André Correia and joined by my co-host, Daniel Guedelha.
Hello and welcome to another show of Cruzamento Podcast. Today, we are with Dan. And hello, Dan, and very welcome to this show.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be here. Thank you for the invite to join you.
Cheers. Thanks, Dan. Thank you very much. So let's go to our very first question. In 30 seconds, who is Dan?
Good question. So I'm Dan Lewy. I am the co-founder and CEO of a rare disease patient advocacy group called the Cure in Action for Tay-Sachs Foundation, which is on a mission to raise awareness for Tay-Sachs and Sandhoff disease.
That was truly 30 seconds, Dan. Thank you very much. Given your involvement in advocating for rare diseases and your role in CATS Foundation, could you provide more details about the charity you are running and its mission in addressing rare diseases?
Yeah, of course. So the CATS Foundation is a rare disease advocacy group set up back in 2011 when my eldest daughter, Emily, was diagnosed with Tay-Sachs disease. At the time, there was no charity in the UK or actually throughout Europe providing any support, research or information. So you kind of got a diagnosis and you were sent home. And Tay-Sachs is a very cruel disease because it robs someone of the ability to function independently. And sadly, people impacted by the infantile, the juvenile form pass away very early on in life. So what we did was we set up to really drive forward support. So you'd walk out a diagnosis with information actually about what the disease was, which was sadly lacking when Emily was diagnosed, but then to really look into the research and see what we could do to drive forward potential clinical studies, engage with pharma, bring the clinicians together to get everyone on the same page, because we realized that we needed to really keep this movement happening of finding a potential treatment for Tay-Sachs and Sandhoff disease, which is another similar condition. So that was kind of how we've evolved over time. And our mission is to really stay to its core, which is support. We want families to come out of a diagnosis knowing they have a support network around them, but also to be aware that we're working really, really hard in the background, driving forward that research to potentially find a treatment for this disease.
Yeah, and you mentioned to gather people around the table, and that is very important, especially in rare diseases, and understanding the complexities of gathering data for these rare diseases. What are, in your view, then, the main challenges you encounter when collecting data, and how do these challenges impact your initiatives?
No, really good question, because my experience, you could imagine, it's been over kind of 12 years now. I've really seen a shift in how people, one, are willing to give data, and then two, how that data is used. And when I say giving data, I'm not just talking about it from the patient perspective or the family perspective. I'm talking about it from the clinician perspective and industry perspective as well, where there's that willingness to share, to drive forward research and drive forward kind of treatment options. So what I've really seen in terms of work that we've done at CATS Foundation is to get that collaborative kind of movement, to get everyone working together, not to see each other as competition, but to actually say, you know, if we work together, we can advance things such as natural history. Because as you all know, natural history is the key, the very early stages, but everyone does the same thing. Like, right, we need to run a natural history study. Do you have patients? And they come to us and, well, we've been participating in 3 of these studies. We actually need to look at it. Can we do something unified as a group that everyone can use that data because it saves so much time and effort and the burden on the patient community because they're not contributing bits of data, all these different studies. That's something that I've seen as a big shift. And with the clinicians, it's getting buy-in from those guys who have these pockets of data rather than having it sitting, you know, siloed away or even just sitting there ready to be published, but then got around to publishing it. We can work together, bringing it kind of in one place and we could all use it because the benefit to the community is absolutely huge. And it kind of frustrates me a bit sometimes when someone has some data that's just sitting there that you want to do something with and they're like, yeah, I need to get around to it. Now I think that's our role in advocacy to give them that push that we can help them do that.
And the rare diseases have some uniqueness around them. And there is also cost, not only just for financially, but also time as well. So Dan, could you explain how the cost associated with collecting the data that you are referring to can affect your efforts in driving that research and also advocating for a better treatment?
No, of course. I think that when I look at it from a company perspective, we have these companies, a lot of them are smaller biotechs. They don't have these huge budgets. So for them, they're looking at a way where they can access the data or collect data that can be used. And I think that collectively by working together, we pool our resources together, our data together, it can be a cost saver to everyone because we know that clinical studies are incredibly expensive. And there is no real point in people reinventing the wheel all the time. So I'm natural history about disease progression. The amount of conversations I had with different companies about we need to do some more research in the natural history. I'm like, well, this company's done it. That company's done it. We've done it. There is information there. Why do you need to do it yourself? And Andre, we've talked previously about advocacy. And one of the things I've always said to you is leverage the expertise of those around you and don't just redo something if it already exists. And I think a lot of the companies now need to smarten up a bit and realize, okay, if someone's already done something, I can use that. I should be able to use it. And I think, again, that's our role in advocacy to put that on the table as a solution, as an option for companies. Otherwise, we're just going to be doing this time and time and time again, which is throwing money at a problem when there's already a solution that exists.
Very interesting, Dan. And that makes me reflect as well on the pharmaceutical industry that obviously could play a very important role here and comes to my mind gene therapy and repurposing. So in your experience that you have been advocating for rare disease within the pharmaceutical industry, could you elaborate on specific skills? It's quite important. And collaborative strategies needed to effectively engage with various stakeholders and drive meaningful change now, such as in gene therapy and drug repurposing, for example.
So this is this is a topic I find interesting. And actually, I reflect on like the 10, 12, 13 years that we've been doing this in terms of the CATS Foundation. One thing I really realized was the ability to sell, but the ability to sell yourself when you're raising funds. So it's going out to the public, you need to raise money. We all need to do that in advocacy. And there are a lot of people very good at storytelling on that side. It's a very sad story. Give us money and you can do quite well. But then I also realized with industry, you had to take that same strategy because in the rare disease space, many of us are super rare. So we're one in 320,000 in terms of incidence rate for Tay-Sachs disease. To get people interested in that, you have to tell them a story. You have to sell to them about why they should be involved in you and actually where's the benefit for them. So for us, our part of our strategy is to go to companies. We have an engaged community. We have data on that community. We have a history and I would say experience being collaborative. We've been involved in different types of studies. We sell our abilities and our services to the industry to say, if you pick us to drive forward a treatment, we will be there with you. We're not going to be confrontational. We're going to challenge, but we're going to challenge in the right way, which is looking at trial design, looking at where you're going to select sites and things like that. But being collaborative is absolutely vital because if we don't and aren't willing to work side by side with an industry partner, then I think you're already shooting yourself in the foot because these people are trying to develop something for your community. So you have to work with them. So I've really seen that ability to sell to them what we can do to help them drive forward their kind of pipeline is absolutely vital. And we've seen successes, we've seen failures. I think you learn a lot from where you've had failures, so you don't make the same mistake again. But what I've really noticed is that you can really speed this stuff up by working hand in hand with your industry partners, but also very clearly at the beginning, setting these guidelines about this is your role and this is what you can provide. I'm not going to step on your science, but I'm going to step on you when it comes to trial design, endpoint selection, engagement strategies, because that's where we have the experience and that's what we can bring to the table.
Can you repeat those ones? So the engagement strategy, so which are the ones that you will say, so it's important, our contribution will be in this and that. So you just told them now, just to repeat.
Yeah, so I would say endpoint selection, trial design, and engagement strategies, and even site selection. And I would go as far as to say to be involved not late on in that process. When you're looking at the phase one, phase two, that's where this engagement should be happening. And that's where you can build that relationship. Because again, Andre, we talked about this before in the past, it's trust. So for us to work with an industry partner who comes in and goes, right, we're running a phase three or a phase four in your disease.
Too late.
Who are you? There isn't a trust. Yeah. So if you're involved at the very beginning, you build this relationship because it is relationship driven. And then there's a real element that you've been involved in that process, your community's been involved, and then you get much better buy-in.
And there is also this, and maybe I'm going to be a bit provocative here, Dan, but I really would like to hear your thoughts about this, because there is the rhetoric around patient well-being coming from the industry, and specifically from the pharmaceutical industry. And you are talking about these strategies that, as a patient advocate, you can use to collaborate. How do we ensure that the companies on their end kind of claim, translates the tangible actions into that, so that the patients can recoup the benefits of such collaboration and such strategy?
No, it's a super question. I tell you why, because what I've seen is buzzwords, patient centricity, patient this, patient that, which sound really good for the first 2 years. And after 3, 4, 5 years, everyone's like, another patient centricity conference, another patient centricity webinar. We're all a bit bored of it. My whole thing is based on trust. We have trust with our community, and our community has trust with us, that we are always driving forward the right relationships, working with the right people. Mm-hmm. So for us to work with a company, we have to have that element of trust, and they have that element of trust with us as well. And once you build that, I really believe that you can have a really kind of fruitful relationship, but it doesn't happen overnight. There's lots of work that goes into it. But also from our side, I think from an advocacy perspective, we also have to not be naive to think it's a one-way street. We also need to work on that relationship. And when you do that, you actually end up being really involved in many parts of a study you may not have realized you'd be involved in the beginning. So when I first started in this world, endpoint selection, trial design, it's all, why would I want to be involved in that? But now I realize how vital it is. That's why we're continuously working with our industry partners to make sure that our viewers heard and listened to as they're developing their studies.
And I think you've mentioned something in one of our conversations as well, Dan, which is very important. Sometimes that conversation can start even if something is not going to happen immediately, right? But let's at least start the conversation and take it forward. Maybe the timing is not the right. Maybe there will be another opportunity. But the key thing is to start talking and to start having that trust being built upon on each one of the sides. Yeah,
I've said to you before, like one of the things I do regularly, maybe once a month, is I just look at what's happening up there, the landscape, similar diseases, what companies doing and what molecule are they trying out, what mode of action that you're looking at, are there any similarities? And then if I think there's an opportunity, just send an email. No time at all, send an email to introduce yourself. What you're doing is great in this disease area. We're from this community. Have you thought about a basket trial? Have you thought about having, you know, another arm to your study? You know, 90% of the time, I then get a reply. 5% of the time, I then get a reply saying no thanks. And then there's one or two who go, that's interesting. Let's meet and have a conversation. And that's how you get things moving. And again, I look back to when we set CATS up in 2011. There's nothing happening. Okay. fast forward to now, we've had gene therapies happen. We've had small molecules drug repurposing, big pharma, small biotechs, all of that happening. And I kind of like when people go, oh, as a community, we're really lucky to be in this position now. I say, no, no, we're not lucky. That's hard work by the entire community, by putting ourselves out there, but also being proactive. Rather than being static and waiting for people to come to us, we'd be going out to these companies, as I said before, selling ourselves to them as a good partner. And that's how you make things happen. Because again, I think one in 320,000, we shouldn't really have that many studies happening if you think in terms of how many diseases are out there. But we have, and that's all by the real hard work we've put in to drive these things forward.
And that's really important. So the trust word, the win-win situation. And I wish that in some years, those numbers and percentages of feedback, they will turn around then. So yeah, so that you get the 90% feedback. And in fact, we were before talking about as well clinical trials and recognizing the importance of those, especially for rare diseases. Linking what you said before, could you elaborate on why transparency in trial design and point selection and enrollment is particularly crucial for advancing treatments in this field?
Again, this is something I've been thinking about a lot in the last few years. The transparency is absolutely vital about a clinical trial. So a lot of the work we do at CATS, like many advocacies, we educate our community. What is a clinical trial? What does it actually mean to take part in one? What are your expectations? A lot of people, and again, I've been here, and I use the phrase regularly that desperate parents do desperate things. You have to educate them to be aware that if you're taking part in a clinical trial, it's a trial. No one knows what's going to happen. It could be successful. It could be unsuccessful. It could have a little impact. It could have zero impact. Educating people, making them aware of this is really important so they understand what they're signing up to, because then they know what they're entering into. And that transparency part from the company is this is what's involved in the study. And this whole kind of burden of impact on a patient, I'm totally on board with. We need to reduce burden on patients taking part in clinical studies, especially when I look at the young babies or young children. But, and I think this is a big but, we also need to be pragmatic that you can't jeopardize the success of a trial by not collecting the right information because you want to have minimal impact on patients. If you're taking part in a study and you have to do a lumbar puncture, you know, every 6 months, there's a reason, okay? But that reason needs to be justified by the company. It can't be just, oh, we want to keep it because there's some bit of information, a bit of data we want to collect there. As long as it's directly impacting the study, you get buy-in from the patient community. And what I've really been seeing now is the challenging of assessments being done in a study. The challenge from our perspective isn't why you're doing it, what you're going to get from it. And as long as that is explained, you generally, the community will buy into that.
And again, with the rare diseases, this trial sometimes is part of the hope as well, because for most of them, there is no one drug that can actually solve the problem. There are maybe some that helps to increase the quality of life. But one of the topics that we sometimes hear about then is this drug repurposing, and specifically within the context of the rare disease, also knowing that developing a drug for a specific rare disease can be very costly given the total population. But what are the considerations involved in terms of toxicology assessments and the rapid execution of clinical trials that could maybe help here understanding a bit better this drug repurposing?
Yes, so drug repurposing, I've seen it be very successful in many diseases out there, is where you have a drug that works in a different indication that tend to have good data so they can bypass the early stages of a clinical study, maybe going to a 2 or a 3. What, from my experience and what we've seen, is that the challenge is one, getting the rights to the drug so it can be tried in a new disease, but also then proving impact it's had. So we look at it in terms of, if you're looking at symptomology, so you're managing a symptom and this drug can impact it, is how you can transfer the data that's been collected already over to the new indication, but also looking at the safety data is the safety data still good enough? Can it still be accepted when you're going to be in regulatory submissions? And actually, a lot of the time, those are the challenges that the companies face, is the safety data good enough for this to accelerate this into human? And when they do, they can actually accelerate very quickly because they've done all of that preclinical work. There's no need to waste that. I say waste, there's no need to do that kind of five, 10 years of piece of work because it's already done. And all of a sudden you have a potential treatment option that tends to slow down as it's moving to later phases. And I think a lot of that needs to be assessed, needs to be reviewed on a regulatory side, how they can speed it up. Because if you have this amazing drug that works in a different disease, managing a symptom, it should be relatively straightforward, I think, to bring it over to a new indication.
Yeah, and let me pick here on the word again, trusts, and linking that with drug repurposing and data. So, given the importance of data sharing for drug repurposing efforts, could you discuss, based on your experience then, the willingness of companies to share data for such initiatives? And most importantly, based on your experience, what are the factors that influence their level of cooperation?
So trust comes to relationships, comes to actually bringing everyone together. And I've seen it more and more in different disease areas. I know, for example, Duchenne in the UK, the guys have been amazing at actually bringing all the companies together to have a conversation about data collection, endpoints, sharing data as well. But it all comes down to actually getting all the key people in a room to have that conversation, to be on board with the idea. I don't think you'll ever get anyone who will say, I don't think it's a good idea to share data with each other. I don't think you will, but you'll always get people challenging this information we've collected. We can't allow anyone else to use. You can embargo it maybe for 5 years, but there'll be natural history data you've collected that could be used, that could supplement someone else's work. The companies that we've worked with are very proactive at sharing, and they want to share. It's actually, where are they going to share it and how are they going to share it? And I think for many of us out there, it's working out how we can overcome that challenge. What is the right platform, for example, to contribute the data to? How can that data be contributed? And I think more importantly, how can it be harmonized? So you have data in one file format, collected data in a specific way. I haven't had different. We can't just throw it into a spreadsheet and go, there we are, data. It needs to be harmonized, it needs to be matched up. You need to look at, do you need a GUID or something? So you're not double counting people. Once that challenge, I think, is overcome, it'll be much easier. And I think a lot of work in the next few years will be on a platform approach that will allow companies to contribute where their data can be segregated off if it needs to be, but also ability to be used in an anonymized way.
And we actually had a past episode where the guest mentions that maybe we have too much data. We just need to know how to use the best out of it, which is a very interesting topic. Yeah.
No, I've heard that before. For one of the companies we work with, they go, we've got so much data, I wouldn't even know where to begin to share. You're like, what are you collecting? I mean, it's good. And you know, I work for a rural evidence company. We will say all data is good data, but you need to know the right data. So how can you pick through it? And I think that's going to be key.
And then I'd like to pivot a little bit here. And I mean, obviously you are a great patient advocate and you have been spending your time on this for a long time now. So drawing from your personal experience, could you share more about how it has shaped your advocacy work and efforts to drive forward the research in this field?
Yeah, I think that when I entered the world, advocacy was changing. But it was also looking at how you could make real impact. So awareness, support, obviously very important. And looking at research again was very important, but making sure we do it in a sustainable way. So not go chasing after every project, but build those relationships with different companies. I think the way that we approached it was, again, to be a bit more professional in our approach, have an infrastructure in place that allowed us to communicate, but also be very clear that we have a role, and our role is as an advocate when we're in these studies. I'm not, as I said before, we're not challenging the science. I've got a PhD in biochemistry or whatever. They're the experts, but if you come to us and ask our opinion about patient burden, for example, or an engagement strategy, we can give it. And I think that's really important. And the big shift I've now seen, and I see it more like a wind tunnel, that we are really proactive in ensuring that we get the opinions from our community outside of the usual people. So not those advocates or those people in our community are always willing to give an opinion on a grade. There are many people out there who aren't as confident to do that. So making sure that their voice is heard, and we talk about equality and equity in trials, I think that's where we need to make a real kind of step to make sure that you're not just hearing from the same people. Because again, I talk about the diagnosis experience for our daughter, Emily, was amazing. She one day stopped very quickly. Actually, she stopped crawling, took her to the GP in London. GP looks at this, this isn't normal. Send her straight to A&E. They do an MRI. They're not very happy. They do some more testing. We're going to test different things. They did an eye test, found a cherry red spot, an indicator of a lysosomal storage disorder that Tay-Sachs is. They had a blood test, diagnosed within two weeks. So we had this child diagnosed quickly. We knew she was going to die. Sadly, she passed away when she was eight in 2017. But we had this period with her where the disease wasn't so intense, where we could take her on holiday and make all these memories. So you talk about my diagnosis experience for Emily. Great, because it was quick. It was clean. There was no stress other than actually getting the diagnosis. While other people, it's horrific. But if I'm giving only my opinion as an advocate and people are only hearing what I am saying, they'll go, great, the diagnosis for Tay-Sachs is really straightforward. People know what they're doing. So it's really important we bring those people out to speak or to give an opinion to companies or to clinicians who don't normally or aren't confident enough to do it, because it's very important to get that completely rounded view of a community.
And then thank you so much for sharing this inspiring history and the vision that you have and the way you have been driving this forward. We really, as well, from Podcast Cruzamento, really appreciate it. And it's an honor for us to be talking with you today. And then we would like really to thank you for your time and availability. So today we talk about rare diseases advocacy, challenges in data collection, transparency that is very crucial in clinical trials and drug repurposing potential, amongst many other things. And then maybe the last question, because your story is just so inspiring, and if people want to know more about you, where can they find you online?
Yes, we're online at cats-foundation.org. So that's cats-foundation.org. Or they can reach me, Dan, at cats-foundation.org. Please reach out. It'd be great.
Dan, thanks very much, and for all the knowledge that you shared. The details are definitely going to be in the show notes. For those that are listening to us or watching us on YouTube, thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to hit the like button and subscribe to our podcast for the latest episodes. Also, connect with us on LinkedIn, Instagram, or any of your favorite podcast apps. Check out the show notes for more details. Thank you very much, and see you soon on Cruzamento Podcast.
Bye, Dan.
Thank you.